Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, how your habits and behavior might influence the behavior of your pets, and how cholesterol-lowering statin drugs were discovered in fungus. But first, how many plastic bottles do you throw out in a week? 3, maybe 4? According to the Environmental Protection Agency, Americans generated 32 million tons of plastic waste in 2012. Lots of that gets tossed into the landfill, but sometimes it can find its way into the ocean. In a study out this week, researchers say that in 2010, an estimated 5 to 13 million metric tons of plastic flowed into the world's oceans, and that's just in 1 year alone. The results of the study were published this week in the journal Science. Will we be swimming in a sea of plastic in the future? Let me introduce my guest. Kara Lavender Law is a co-author of that study. She's also a research professor of oceanography at the Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much.
There was an estimate put out in 2014 based on the amount of plastic floating in the ocean. How does your study compare to that estimate?
Well, we are looking at sort of the other side of the equation. So rather than looking at ocean measurements to estimate how much plastic is out there already, we're looking at the amount of plastic that's entering the ocean from waste that was generated on land. So basically, we're looking at what's coming out of the faucet rather than what's already in the bathtub. And we're finding a huge discrepancy. The amount that we estimate is 20 to 2,000 times larger coming from land than what's already out there floating.
Wow. And so where does it go?
Well, that's one of the big research questions that we're starting to address. We know that not all plastic floats, so certainly some of this trash that enters the ocean sinks right down to the seafloor, and there have been people that look at this on continental shelves and more recently looking in the deep sea. And we also know, for all of us who've gone to the beach, that plastic trash is abundant there, everything from little bits of microplastics smaller than your fingernail all the way up to giant docks washing ashore from the Japanese tsunami and everything in between. But the most abundant form on beaches is, of course, things that we use every day, things like cigarette filters and bottle caps and food packaging.
So, you know, when I throw something out, I throw it into the garbage. And I assume that it gets to a landfill or something. So what's happening in that stream that's sending it out into the ocean?
Yeah, well, that depends on where you are in the world. So our study was at global estimates. So what we did was looked at waste generation and what happens to that waste in 192 countries around the world that have a coastline. And what we found was that the biggest contributors were actually countries that have growing economies, these developing countries where their waste generation rates are increasing very quickly, but they don't have the capacity to deal with that waste. So in that case, this is an infrastructure problem. But the second class of contributors are people like us in the United States and in the high-income countries, where we have very high waste generation rates. So the amount of trash that you and I produce each day is much higher than in most countries around the world. In the U.S., we also have a really large coastal population. So if you take that and think about the small amount, the small percentage of waste that somehow escapes the garbage can or the garbage truck and enters the ocean, because we have such a huge generation, this actually translates to a large number.
So we're talking then a problem of really waste management, of how to manage the waste we throw out.
It is. It's waste generation and waste management. Mm-hmm. So that you can solve the problem in two different ways. I think the immediate solution is, yes, it's waste management. We need to build infrastructure in countries that are lacking right now to capture the waste. We simply want to prevent it from entering the ocean. But in places where we have that infrastructure already, we want to reduce the amount of waste that we create. That's at least one aspect of the solution.
What about sources that originate in the sea? Is there plastic falling off of ships, things like that?
Yeah, so that's a really important point. What our study looked at simply was waste generated on land. So we didn't even account for things like lost fishing gear or lost aquaculture gear. We didn't think about the containers of Nikes or rubber ducks that fall off ships. And we didn't think about we didn't consider the material that comes into the ocean from natural disasters like hurricanes or floods or tsunamis. So really, this is a minimum estimate.
So, and if you took the whole picture together, is there a better estimate that you could come up with?
Not yet. That's the next phase of our work, is to look at those additional sources. Although our suspicion is that the waste from land is probably the biggest number. But it does matter where this waste is coming from when you want to think about designing solutions. And there are people actively already thinking about, you know, how do we prevent or capture lost fishing gear, for example.
Yeah. What about, is there a difference between the giant pieces, you know, that come from the bottles and the trash bags like that, to the waste that we've heard about, like little microparticles in the ocean?
Yeah, so this is sort of points to one gap in our understanding, is how long it takes for those big items, once they enter the ocean, to turn into those little microplastics that are smaller than your fingernail. We don't have a good sense of that time scale. There's another class of materials that start out that small, things like microbeads that are in cosmetic products or personal care products, or scrubbers that are used in industrial purposes. So the sources come in all sizes, from almost microscopic all the way up to, you know, huge debris coming off from a natural disaster. And the impacts of those different items vary based on the animal that encounters them.
So there must be, since we have nanoparticles just about everywhere now, I imagine there must be lots of nanoparticles in that debris also.
So. That's what we suspect. You know, we don't have a good sense of how small plastic breaks down in the ocean. If you talk to the polymer scientists, they'll tell you that it'll just get turned into smaller and smaller pieces, down to nanoparticles, and it'll still remain a plastic polymer. But we don't have a good sense of how many of those nanoparticles are out there. We don't have a good way to measure them just yet.
Mm-hmm. So the nanoparticles, do we know how they interact with the wildlife that's living, breathing, eating in the ocean?
Yeah, we do. For the microplastics, which are, you know, typically a millimeter, a couple millimeters in size, or maybe even smaller, we know that these are easily eaten by a wide variety of marine animals, ranging from invertebrate marine worms or barnacles up to seabirds and sea lions and even whales. And when an animal eats a small bit of plastic, we have a number of concerns. First, there could be, depending on the size of plastic, there could be internal damage, but also just a false sense of feeling full. We know there's no nutritional value in plastic. But I think the area where there's the most concern right now is in the toxins that might be associated with these plastics. So we know that when plastics are manufactured, a variety of additives are included to give them certain properties, flexibility or flame retardants or color. Mm-hmm. And some of these additives are known toxins. Secondly, we know that plastics, when they're drifting in the ocean, act as little sponges, and they accumulate other persistent toxins that have been in the ocean for decades, things like PCBs and DDT. So we're concerned that when animals eat these little bits of plastic, those toxins might transfer into their tissues and potentially up the food web. And in laboratory work, this has been shown to occur. But right now, we're not entirely clear on the risk in the actual ocean.
Well, Professor, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating.
Thanks very much.
Carol Lavender Law is a research professor of oceanography at Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Starting the end of this weekend, the Westminster Dog Show kicks off in New York City. And when it comes to the best of dogs and dog breeds, it's not just about the looks. Maybe you thought it was. It's also about who behaves best. But how much does breed have to do with dog behavior? Can a surly golden retriever or a lazy Jack Russell win at Westminster? Well, maybe not. Video producer Luke Roskin went to the show last year, and here's what he heard from several owners.
They're basically a gentle giant. They're very, very laid back. And the credo for Irish Wolfhounds, which is very true, is gentle when stroked, fierce when provoked.
And that's maybe why I like poodles, because they are, you know, the Dobermans with hair. Very smart.
He has a very loving, sweet personality, which is part of the breed standard for pugs.
The disciplined dogs you heard about were Champion, Pearl, and Remy. Or Remy. We just heard a few of the standard trait dogs are supposed to have, from being friendly, smart, to smart and friendly. In this week's video pick, Luke took a closer look at whether or not the breed influenced behavior. Welcome to the program, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Breed influencing behavior.
That's right.
Were the dog owners and the handlers convinced that their dogs' personalities were typical of their breed?
They absolutely devoutly believed that the breed was the the sole or the largest contributing factor to their dog's breed. Now, to their behavior. Now, that makes sense given that these are show dogs.
Right.
You know, they wanting to fit the standard is critical. You know, you want your Pekingese to be sweet and charming and your Boxer to be bouncy and your Border Collie to be wicked smart,
mm-hmm.
Especially if you're a dog show and those are the standards for those breeds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they believed it, you know, almost religiously.
Yeah. Was then the breed seen the biggest, that was the biggest factor in a dog behavior. They were sure
that. Oh, yes. Yeah. And you know, you don't need to go to the dog show to kind of experience that. If you're watching it at TV, on TV, you can actually hear the announcers kind of reinforcing what the breed standard is.
The Portuguese Water Dog is an intelligent, athletic breed. Spirited dogs, they are always ready for a full day's activity in or out of the water and require owners of equal stamina and intelligence.
So then you would expect every dog to behave like that.
Yeah,
right?
you would hope that you are as smart as your dog. Every breed, dependent, no matter what the breed is.
Yeah.
So you can hear that these buzzwords being passed about in the narration, you know, loyal dog, family dog, about different breeds. And, you know, this is kind of what our video is about. Where did these kind of breed behavior standards come from? And are they accurate? Are they true?
Yeah, so we want to ask our audience about their dogs. We're going to have a shout out to our audience and hope that they'll respond. Your dog might look like you, but do you think it acts like you, right? Do you think your behavior influences how your dog behaves? Give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Or you can tweet us at SciFry. Let me repeat what we want to say. Your dog might look like you, right? We all say people like their dogs. But do you think it acts like you? Do you think your behavior influences how your dog behaves? We're going to come back after you give us that call. We're going to talk to animal behaviorist James Serpel. His research was featured in our video pick this week by Luke Raskin, sitting here right with me. Is pedigree all it's cracked up to be? It's up there on our website. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll talk more about your dogs after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, our show has gone to the dogs. Specifically, if you own a dog, do you think that your behavior influences how your dog behaves? I'm sure you have thought about this. All of we dog owners have. And to get to the bottom of how much breed might have to do with dog behavior, James Serpel developed a 101-question survey for dog owners. And tens of thousands of owners responded. He joins us now to discuss the results. James Serpel is director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. That is where he joins us from today. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira.
Hey there. Tell us about the survey. It's called Seabark, B-A-R-Q. What is that? What's going on there?
Oh, it's the Canine Behavioral Assessment and Research Questionnaire, which spells out Seabark.
Mm-hmm. How many dog owners have taken the survey so far?
Oh, wow. Well, we have about 26,000 pet owners now have taken the survey and given us complete records on their dogs, and probably about the similar number of working dogs, like guide dogs and service dogs.
So these people are asked to sort of self-report on themselves.
Exactly, yes. The survey is designed to kind of ask them questions about how their dog typically responds to sort of everyday events and things going on in the house.
So as results of the survey, did you find that breed was a factor in the behavior?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
So there are definitely highly statistically significant breed differences in behavior pretty much across the board. Doesn't really matter very much which type of behavior you look at. The breeds are different.
Mm-hmm. But you know what was surprising in doing the research on this is finding out which dog was the most aggressive one. We would all think of the pit bull, right? That's the Hollywood dog that's most aggressive.
No, pit bulls were quite average, at least in terms of their aggression towards people. But they were high in relation to aggression towards other dogs, which is kind of what you'd expect given their history and involvement in dog fighting. No, the breeds that were most aggressive tended to be small dogs. The little dog breeds were highly aggressive in many cases. Things like Dachshunds, Chihuahuas, And one of the reasons I think for that is that simply people are more tolerant of aggression in little dogs because they can't do so much harm.
Hmm. You know, when it comes to humans, we often associate aggressive dog behavior as a dog trying to establish itself as an alpha male, an alpha dog. Is this what dogs are doing?
Probably not, no. We don't have much evidence that dogs are even aware of those kinds of social hierarchies. Unfortunately, this kind of idea gets promulgated in the popular media by sort of so-called dog whisperers who are out there encouraging people to kind of be authoritarian with their dogs and assert themselves as pack leaders and all that sort of nonsense. But the truth of the matter is that most dogs usually have a good reason for being aggressive, and probably the most common reason why a dog is aggressive is because it's afraid.
Hmm. Do we teach it to be afraid? Are they following our cues?
They may be in some cases, although not necessarily directly. For example, years ago we did a study of the relationship between the owner personality and the behavior of the dog, and we did find that very shy people, for example, very sort of neurotic, shy, retiring people tended to have more aggressive dogs. And one interpretation would be that the dog's responding directly to the owner's shyness by being more aggressive. But another sort of complicating factor may be that shy people don't socialize their dogs properly when they're young. Hmm. And so these animals aren't getting the right sort of early experience, and that makes them more aggressive.
Hmm. Do we influence how they might behave to other dogs? If we're walking our dog and there's another dog on the other side of the street, if we show fear of that dog, is our dog going to be fearful of that dog also?
That's a really good question, and I don't think anybody really has an answer for it. It's certainly well established in the kind of popular mythology about dogs that sort of dogs can pick up on their owner's feelings and emotions and react to them. But we actually have very little scientific evidence for that.
Let's see if we can go to the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Carl in Utah. Hi, Carl.
Thank you. Hello.
Yes. Go ahead. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I don't typically call in, but I just was thinking about my chocolate lab, Oscar, and he seems to mimic me pretty closely. He's kind of old and lazy and fat and lays around the house and likes to eat a lot. So I thought, yeah, very much my dog is a lot like me. So.
Does he look like you too?
No, not too much. He's a bit more hairy. Although our stomachs are really similar. So,
James, is that a coincidence, or does he just not exercise enough and not therefore exercise his dog enough?
I have a feeling it's something that an awful lot of old Labrador owners would say. Labradors do like their food, notoriously, and if they eat a lot, they will be quite lazy. So maybe there's a spurious correlation there.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Shannon. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
I was just answering the question about how dogs do act like their owners. They certainly do. I think our behavior is definitely representative of the dog's behavior. However, most owners don't have a clue.
Do you deal with dogs?
Oh, yeah, I'm a dog trainer.
You're a dog trainer, and you think that the behavior is representative of their owner?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Because people just do not realize it.
James?
Yeah, well, it's like I say, it's a very common observation that the dogs respond to some aspect of the owner's behavior. And essentially learn things or learn habits as a result of contact with the owner. Mm-hmm. And we do have this relationship between the personality of the owner and the behavior of the animal. So clearly something's going on, but we don't have much information about exactly how the dog is doing it, what the dog's responding to, whether it's responding to some kind of nonverbal signals that the owner is giving. It might be something very direct. For example, with we found with guide dog owners that the some personality types were more inclined to correct the dog's behavior with some sort of physical correction, like a pulling on the leash or something mm-hmm. like that. And it turned out that this was having apparently an adverse effect on the dog's behavior. So the dogs, probably because the handler was not timing the corrections very well, they were confusing the dog. So the dog was not getting the right message and was getting confused by the signals that he was getting. So that sort of thing, I think, goes on a lot.
We have a tweet from Gordon who says, I'm an ER nurse and have seen many facial bites when they blow into the face of a chihuahua. Ooh, ooh. I would bite back, too, if someone was blowing in my face.
Well, exactly, especially if you were a chihuahua because, you know, they're so tiny and everybody else is much, much bigger than them. So you could understand why chihuahuas are on the defensive most of the time.
Yeah. What is the biggest misconception that people have about dog behavior?
Well, I think probably the most widespread one is the assumption that, you know, when a dog does something wrong, it understands what it's done. So people, for example, will, you know, go out of the room, leave the dog in the kitchen. The dog will pull something down off the kitchen counter. You know, sometime later, the person will come back in the room and then get really mad at the dog because they see this and they assume somehow the dog's going to make the connection between their anger and what it did. But unless your response is absolutely immediate, the dog probably won't make the connection, and the dog will just be very confused. One minute you were a nice owner, and the next minute you were not nice. And dogs can get terribly confused by that sort of thing. And when they get confused, often their behavior problems become worse. You know, they mm-hmm. become more extreme. So I think that's probably the most common error that people make, is the assumption that a dog knows when it's done something wrong.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones, to Iowa City. Tia, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I have a question. So I have a corgi, and I'm 23 years old, and my dog is in the first year of its life. And when I got the corgi, I was recommended a corgi from some friends who have a couple of them, and I knew them to be smart and quick and troublemakers for the most part. But I found that my dog is, like, oddly quick to pick things up, and I'd love to say that that is because I'm oddly quick to pick things up, but I was just wondering if that is, like, always the case. I do have a friend who has a corgi who actually is a little bit slower, and I wouldn't say that my friend is slower. Well, I would say that. I would say that, like, it's just not as quick to pick up information. Is that more like a raised thing or just all corgis in general?
So you want to take credit for that, and you want to know if it's actually the breed or whether the owner. Good question. What do you say, James?
Well, corgis are quick. Like many herding dogs, they're very quick. They're extremely sharp. They're very observant, so they pick up on tiny changes in owners' nonverbal signals. These are signals we aren't even aware we're giving. So sometimes they seem almost kind of supernaturally quick because we're not aware that we're giving them cues. And that's a sort of clever hands type of effect that you see it quite often with smart dogs. But they are, I think we underestimate just how how quick dogs are and how observant they are and how they can pick up on these tiny changes in our behavior and act on them.
Such as what kind of cues are you talking about?
Well, for example, we all go through kind of elaborate preambles before we go out of the house. So our behavior changes. We're not really aware of it, but it might involve, you know, going upstairs, coming downstairs, looking for our keys, you know, looking for our glasses, whatever it is we're doing preparatory to going out. But once we begin that pattern of behavior, the dog will pick up on that immediately, and it will be waiting by the front door saying, you know, hurry up, it's time to go out, because they've picked up on it long before we've really actually probably even made a conscious decision that we're leaving, because we're already showing these kind of preliminaries. And dogs just learn that stuff so quickly.
Right. If we're anxious an anxious person, if we're, as I'm going to say, a mean person, I don't know exactly what that means, but will our dogs pick up on that and act that way, anxious or short-tempered, let's put it like that?
I'm sure they will, but the mechanism we don't know. In other words, we don't know how they're doing it, but I'm sure they'll pick up on it.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. If you just joined us, we're talking about dogs with James Serpel, director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania. What is the biggest mistake that people make when they're trying to change their dog's behavior?
Well, the use of punishment is generally speaking to be avoided if you can. You can change almost everything about a dog's behavior just by judicious use of rewards. You know, reward the dog when it does something right as opposed to punishing it when it does something wrong. And most dogs don't need to be punished. It's not usually helpful, and it may actually frighten the dog, and a frightened dog can become difficult to handle and may become aggressive if it's actually seriously frightened. And so I'm always recommending that, you know, if you can possibly avoid it, don't do anything that punishes or frightens a dog. I mean, there are sort of extreme situations, for example, a dog that, you know, is always trying to dart out into the road or something like that, that puts its own life in danger, where a certain amount of correction may be necessary. But these kinds of things that are, you know, some people advocate, like throwing the dog on its back when it misbehaves, I think is stupid. I think it's potentially dangerous because the dog may get frightened enough to bite you. And it's setting the dog up for future failure because the dog will become very anxious in the same situation the next time because it'll be worried about this this type of behavior on the part of the owner. So you do have to handle most dogs with kid gloves.
Let's go to Mason in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi, Mason. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, guys. How are y'all doing?
Hey there.
I was commenting back on the dogs. Like use the example, the dog would eat something off the counter and there were a time period would go by and you would punish the dog and he wouldn't know why. When my dog does anything like this, he'll hide for a period of time and without me even knowing what he's done wrong. And I mean, if he ate something off the counter, he would hide for an hour. And unless I went in and figured it out, I wouldn't know. I mean, the dog clearly knows when he does something that he's not supposed to or not for a lengthy period of time. And as far as rewarding a dog when it hasn't done something it's not supposed to do, how would, if they're intelligent enough to figure that out, how are they not intelligent enough to figure out it's not supposed to eat your turkey sandwich off the counter?
Okay, you know? Good questions.
Well, in most cases in those situations, the dogs learn from experience. So if it's had a prior experience of being shouted at or smacked or whatever, as a result of stealing food, then it will be able to make the association. But what the association it's making is simply, if I eat food, someone's going to smack me. It doesn't mean that it understands why it's being smacked or why it's going to be shouted at. So there we're imputing too much knowledge, really, to the dog, whereas all you really need from the dog's perspective is to make the association. If I eat the food off the counter, someone's going to shout at me or smack me. They can certainly learn that kind of association, mm-hmm. but don't expect them to know why you're smacking them. That's what I'm saying.
And in about a minute I have left, there was an interesting research out this week that showed that dogs can tell the difference between happy and angry human faces. There was a new study in the Cell Press journal, Current Biology. You agree with that?
I think it's quite possible, yes. After all, there's a lot of similarities in the faces of humans and dogs. So we have rather similar facial muscles, and we use them in quite similar ways. And a happy dog often does look as though it's smiling. So it seems quite reasonable to me that a dog would see the same kind of features in a human face and be able to read the mood of the person into that.
Thank you very much, James. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
James Serpel, director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And you can see him in many of the breeds in our new video up on sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week, all about dogs. We're going to take a break. We're going to be talking about stories of broken hearts. It's Valentine's Day, but these are scientists and surgeons who have sought to mend maladies of the heart. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI. Hey, podcast listeners. Take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. If you laid all your blood vessels, your arteries, your veins, and your capillaries out in a straight line, how far do you think they'd go? 50 miles? 1,000 miles? Try 60,000 miles. Yep. Those many miles of vasculature, of course, eventually all lead back to your heart. But it's only relatively recently, and that means in the last 100 years or so, that scientists have really untangled some of the big mysteries of this hugely important organ, how it works, how it evolved, and how to fix it. You and I call it the heart. My next guest calls it the neediest muscle in the body. Rob Dunn is the author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, True Tales of Science, Surgery, and Mystery. He's an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Oh, thanks so much, Ira. It's great to be back.
You're welcome. We have an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/heartbook if you'd like to get a leg up on or a vasculature up on reading it. Rob, let's talk about the guy referred to in the title of the book, the man who, yes, touched his own heart, Werner Forssmann, who came up with this idea over drinks at a bar, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes people do things that at the time you can't tell whether they're totally foolhardy or heroic, and it takes years to figure it out. And he was one of those guys. He became convinced of the idea that maybe there was a way to see what was going on in the heart in a living patient, and nobody could do it at the time. And he'd seen a picture of a study in which someone had threaded a catheter up the vein of a horse into the horse's heart, and he thought at the bar, I'll do this on people. And so he then went back to his office, and he was a resident at the time, low guy on the totem pole, and he told his boss, I want to thread a catheter up the vein of a patient into their heart and see if it works and see if, you know, if this could be something that sets the stage for bigger steps. Mm-hmm. And his boss, being a reasonable person, said no. And so Forssmann said, well, let me do it on myself. And his boss said no again told him to go work on some rabbits or something. But Forssmann was not a guy to be easily deterred, and so he went home to think about it and talk to other people. And apparently he was very, very persuasive, because he convinced a nurse at the hospital to let him perform this procedure that he had just imagined on her. And that would be the next step. They would go in, and he strapped her down to do the procedure and turned his back, and then proceeded to send a catheter up his own arm vein toward his own heart.
Well, she was lying strapped down on her own table?
Yeah, she was lying strapped down. She couldn't do anything. She screamed. She told him to stop. And it turned out that he needed her help, because he couldn't get into the cabinet with the catheters without her. and so he starts pushing this up his arm, and she tells him to stop, but she can't get up. And he gets it all the way to what he thinks is his heart. And this is this critical moment, because it turns out they've used a room in the hospital that doesn't have an X-ray machine. And so they can't prove that they've done this. And so he unstraps her and tells her they need to walk two flights of stairs down to get to the room that has an X-ray machine, which is what they proceed to do. And it's this amazing moment, because he really has no idea in that moment how dangerous what he's just done is. And, you know, will he die on the way down the stairs? Will this catheter bouncing around in his heart immediately kill him if it bounces the wrong way? He doesn't know. But they make it. They get downstairs, and downstairs they bump into one of his friends, who tells him, Werner, you can't do this, and tries to rip the catheter out. Werner pushes past, gets to the X-ray machine, They take the picture and it's not quite all the way to the heart, so he pushes it some more. They take another picture and it's all the way in the heart. And this is the moment. This is the first attempt at what will become a huge medical industry of cardiology, of intervening in the heart through the veins and eventually arteries. And so it's a heroic moment, but it won't go on to quite feel that way for Werner for quite a few years.
He went on to win the Nobel Prize for that little experiment.
He did. There were some hard years in between, but what he first heard was that two Americans who had built on his work had won the Nobel Prize, and then later he found out that he'd also won it with them. And so that was a great vindication for what he'd outrageously done.
You are really fascinated with the heart. I can tell from reading this book. And then you make us all fascinated by the history, the surgery, and some of the strange and wild things these researchers did to prove their point.
I am. I'm totally fascinated because on the one hand, it's this very simple pump, right at the center of our body. And we imagine that if we understand anything about our body, clearly it must be this pump. On the other hand, it's only very recently that we've started to understand it. You know, there have been fits and starts going back a couple of thousand years, but most of what we think of as our modern knowledge is recent. And then still, the other piece that really fascinates me is that there are major mysteries of the heart, things that we totally don't understand, that it's inconceivable to me that we don't understand them yet. And that there they are. You have this heart, it beats in your body, you depend on it every day, and we don't know key pieces of how it works.
Such as?
And so, well, for example, for years it was assumed that if you looked at the hearts of different primates, that they were basically the same. And in fact, the very first heart transplant that was attempted was actually a baboon heart that was transplanted into a human. And it didn't work, but it was thought that the person it was transplanted into was just too far gone. And the assumption in doing that was that the hearts were just similar enough that it should work. You know, the baboon heart was a little too small. But nobody really checked. And it was known that if you looked at chimps and humans, both chimps and humans have heart attacks. And so it was assumed that those were the same. And it wasn't until 2011 that Nissi Varki at the University of San Diego started comparing the hearts of chimps and humans that have both had heart attacks. And it became almost immediately clear that they weren't the same at all, that the chimps were having a totally different kind of heart attack due to fibrosis, where the muscles sort of go across each other and contractions stop. And so this is 2011. It's incredibly recent. And what this then does is, instead of resolving one mystery, it presents two new ones. And the first is, why do we have the kind of heart attack we do, which is a different kind? Most often the coronary arteries clog and the heart doesn't get enough oxygen to itself. And then why do chimps have this other kind of heart attack that we don't get? And Nissi thinks she has some ideas as to what's going on there. But for the most part, it's still a mystery. And to me, that is a mystery. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, that's so fundamental to who we are.
How did our hearts evolve to be what they are? And why do we have a heart? Why do our coronary arteries get clogged up if we're active and whatever? Is there something about evolution that's not complete there?
Yeah, well, those are all the great questions that kept me up at night writing this book. One of the pieces there is, why do the coronary arteries clog? And so these are these relatively small arteries that go from the, as the blood's going out of the left ventricle, there are these arteries that come right back toward the heart and feed it. And they're not very big, and there aren't very many of them. And it turns out they're remarkably similar to the coronary arteries of, say, fish or others of our ancestors. And what it looks like has happened is that through time they've enlarged a little bit, but they've not increased in number. And so we're limited by the number that we started with 100 million years ago or more. So it's a design problem, because evolution doesn't get to design things anew. It works within the constraint of its history. And so if you were designing a heart, I think you would probably give it some extra coronary arteries so that if a couple clog, it's less catastrophic. But instead, it evolved. And so it has this legacy by which we're burdened.
So we basically have the same heart as a fish that we
descended from. It has the legacy of the fish heart. Many things have changed.
Yeah, but it in the book you write about the strange and obscure origins of some of the most groundbreaking heart drugs, like statins. Tell us about the origin and the discovery, really, of statins.
Statins are fascinating. A Japanese scientist, Akira Endo, who's still alive, grew up collecting fungi. He grew up during the war, or just after the war, and so he grew up in a time of great hardship. And so he and his family ate lots of fungi that they gathered. And his grandfather taught him about all of the ways that mushrooms in particular can attack other organisms and deal with the fact that they're stuck where they are. And so they have to use chemistry in warfare. And so he went on to a job working with fungi. And he was convinced that if he could tap the great potential of fungi, that the fungi themselves used to fight other organisms, that he could do good things. And so the first thing he tried to do was to figure out a way to get the pectin out of cider wine. And so he looked for a fungus that might do this in nature, and he found one on grapes, and it was a huge success. And that success propelled him to the U.S., where he found lots of people suffering from heart disease. And so he thought, well, maybe I can figure out a way to solve the problem of high cholesterol associated with heart disease, which wasn't a huge problem in Japan, but in the U.S. it was. And so he went back to Japan, and he started screening fungi that might have the ability to affect the production of cholesterol. And he knew that bacteria have metabolic processes very similar to the process of producing cholesterol. And so he thought that maybe the fungi over evolutionary time had figured out a way to fight that, in order to fight the bacteria, in order to be able to eat dead stuff and compete with the bacteria. And so he had to find all of these fungi in nature. And the first 3,000 he tested, none of them worked. And the number 3,001, it worked. But then it gave the rats he tried it in kidney stones. And so he went back to the drawing board, did another 3,000, finally got one that worked in the petri dish sort of test. And when he tried it in rats, it didn't work. And, you know, this years have gone by, and he's disillusioned, and this is sort of the end. But then he bumps into a friend who's got a bunch of chickens. And so he basically says, hey, can I borrow your chickens? And borrow is probably the wrong word, because the chickens were not coming back. But he takes the chickens, and he tries it on the chickens. And this fungus, it works. And it works, and it becomes the predecessor of statins. And so all statins ultimately derive from this invention and subsequent work in the same vein, this effort of Akira Endo over years and years to borrow from what nature has already done. And I think that happens again and again in the heart, that the more we look to nature for other kinds of insights into how to deal with this funny organ in our center, that the more success we have.
It's quite fascinating. Rob Dunn is author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, True Tales of Science, Surgery, and Mystery, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And it really is. You tell some fascinating, fascinating stories that we've never heard of it, you know? And as far as early science on the heart, you write about this amazing glass heart model that Leonardo da Vinci built.
Oh, yeah. Da Vinci was just an amazing character. And he did many, many dissections, and in theory, these were dissections to help him be a better painter, a better sculptor. But it's very clear if you look at what he wrote when he was doing these dissections, that he was also just fascinated with finding the truth of the body, at figuring out how it worked. And not all of the knowledge of antiquity had been passed on to him, and so he was starting in part from scratch. And so he had two major discoveries of the heart, and one is he was looking at the heart's valves. And one of the valves has this three-part component. It's like three flaps that are not muscular, and it's the valve going from the left ventricle out to the body, and so huge quantities of blood go through it. And these flaps then flap back down, and we can now see this in videos of the pig heart and all sorts mm-hmm. of things. How Da Vinci saw it, not totally clear. But the big question was how they flap back down when they don't have a muscular device to pull them down. And Da Vinci noticed that on the far side of this valve was a little opening. And he had noticed that when he watched rivers, that when water went through a narrow area and then hit a wider area, that the water would form eddies that would push backwards. And so what Da Vinci thought was that maybe the same thing was happening in this heart valve, and it was then pushing the valve closed. And so he actually devised a glass heart valve that I think he actually built it. It's a little bit of ambiguity whether he built it or just imagined what it would be mm-hmm. like if he built it. And was able to show using that this principle could work. What's the most amazing about that is that because nobody built on any of Da Vinci's science, it was essentially totally lost, this principle would not be rediscovered until 1969.
Wow.
And when it was, the new drawings of it, you know, done by clever scientists, are not anywhere near as beautiful as Da Vinci's. And so, you know, there's all of this history, and it's not always linear.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful to discover that sort of stuff. In a couple of minutes that I have left, I want to bring up one of our favorite topics, and that's the microbiome. We know about the microbiome living in our intestines. Shouldn't there be a microbiome inside that big chamber in the heart? Why shouldn't there be a microbiome in there too?
Well, for a long time we've thought about the cardiovascular system as being really sterile, and it's now clear that that's not true. There's lots of stuff living in your lungs. There's a fungus that seems to only live in the lungs of mammals. Nobody knows what it does. Is it good? Is it bad? You have it, Ira. I have it. But the blood also is full of all kinds of critters. And in the very few studies to look at the heart, historically, there have been samples of individual species of bacteria living in the heart, but nobody's used modern methods to really look comprehensively.
Yeah,
so the truth is we don't have a good picture of what's living there.
This is fascinating. It's fascinating. And your book is fascinating. It's a great read. The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, Rob Dunn, is the author. He's an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Thank you. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Ira.
Thanks for the
book. Such a pleasure.
It's great. We have an excerpt of the book, as I say, at sciencefriday.com/heartbook. Before we go, I want to wish all of you a happy Valentine's Day, and we asked some of our favorite Science Friday guests to come up with some special Valentine's wishes of their own, and here's a taste of what we heard. This one is from UC Berkeley mathematician Edward Frankel, author of Love and Math.
When we mathematicians want to express our affection, we might say something like, "You are my unique isomorphism." Well, that didn't come out very passionately. Let me try again. "You are my unique isomorphism." Something like that. Anyway, I hope you guys have a good time. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Edward. Happy Valentine's Day to you, too. And we have actually a full library of those science valentines on our website at sciencefriday.com/valentines. You can print them out. You can share them with the geeks that you love. And while you're on our website, that's our video pick of the week. Is Pedigree all it's cracked up to be? Make sure you check out that video also. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. We had up today from our studio production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of our program, you'd like to hear it again, yeah, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. Point your tablet, smartphone, or anything that you like to use to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can also join our mailing list. And if you like us, then like us, become a friend on Facebook. Continue a week-long discussion with us on Twitter @SciFry. Have a great weekend. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.